Honey and the Rock performing down by the riverside years ago in our firehouse studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. President Donald Trump has abruptly demolished the entire East Wing of the White House in what is perhaps a perfect metaphor, many people are saying, about what he's doing to the institutional pillars of our democracy, tearing them down with authoritarian hubris, answering to no one as he erects yet another garish monument. This comes as the government shutdown enters its 24th day, with Republican majorities in Congress facing growing criticism, some of it from within the party itself. House Republican Congress member Marjorie Taylor Greene spoke Tuesday on the Tucker Carlson show.
I have no respect for Speaker Johnson not calling us back to Washington, because we should be passing bills. We should be passing bills that reflect the president's executive orders, which are exactly what we voted for. We should be at work on our committees. We should be doing investigations. And you want to know something? We should be passing the discharge petition that Thomas Massie put in to release the Epstein files. Many times I hate my own party, and I blame Republicans for many of the problems that we have today. And I blame them for being so America last, to the point where they are literally slaves to all the big industries in Washington, the military industrial complex, big pharma, health insurance industries, you name it. They are literally slaves to them, and they love the foreign war so much.
Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican, has also called for the extension of the Affordable Care Act subsidies, a key demand of Democrats to end the government shutdown. She wrote on X, quote, "I'm going to go against everyone on this issue, because when the tax credits expire this year, my own adult children's insurance premiums for 2026 are going to double, along with all the wonderful families and hardworking people in my district," unquote. Well, today we look at the growing fissures within the Republican Party, as Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson refuses to swear in the Democratic Congressmember-elect Adelita Grijalva of Arizona, who would be the final vote on a discharge petition to release the Epstein files. Republican Thomas Massie co-sponsored the rare bipartisan bill to require the release of the full Epstein files. So far, four Republicans have signed on in addition to Massie. Yes, Republican Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene, Nancy Mace of South Carolina, and Lauren Boebert of Colorado, all Republicans. Meanwhile, as Trump sends federal forces into Democrat-led cities like Chicago, the Republican governor of Oklahoma, who's also the head of the National Governors Association, Governor Stitt, has criticized the move, telling the New York Times, quote, "Oklahomans would lose their mind if troops were sent into their red state." This all comes as Trump's nominee to lead the Office of Special Counsel, Paul Ingrassia, withdrew from consideration Tuesday following widespread backlash, including of Republicans, over a slew of racist texts. He texted a group of Republicans that he has a, quote, "Nazi streak," adding that the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday should be, quote, "tossed into the seventh circle of hell," unquote. After the texts were made public by Politico, several Republican senators said they wouldn't support his nomination, including the Senate Majority Leader John Thune. Vermont State Senator Samuel Douglas has just formally resigned over his comments in the chat. For more, we go to Vermont, where we're joined by Stuart Stevens, a former Republican political operative who worked on George W. Bush's presidential campaign and was the chief strategist for Mitt Romney in 2012. Stevens did not support Donald Trump as a Republican candidate either time. He's a senior advisor to the Lincoln Project and the author of 9 books, including The Conspiracy to End America, 5 Ways My Old Party is Driving Our Democracy to Autocracy, and It Was All a Lie, How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump. His recent essay for Zatteo is headlined, "My Plea to Democrats, Stop Being Polite, Go Nuclear." He also writes for the Lincoln Substack. We welcome you back to Democracy Now! Thanks so much for being with us, Stuart Stevens. Is there a growing fissure within the Republican Party? Are these divisions significant?
First of all, it's great to be here. Thanks for asking me. I think that What's happening with Marjorie Taylor Greene is very specific to her desire to run as a statewide candidate in Georgia. And as we've seen, Georgia is increasingly a purple state. There's actually a lot of suburban voters that are not comfortable with the sort of ugliness of the ICE raids, are not comfortable with the idea that the, you know, East Wing is being torn down. They're not comfortable with the idea that Trump won't release the Epstein files. So she's trying to appeal to those voters. I think it would be a mistake to make too much of these fissures, because Donald Trump has a control over the Republican Party, unlike anything I think we've seen in modern political history.
So let's talk about the different issues. For example, the Epstein files. You have one Republican after another now joining the Democrats and demanding they be released. I mean, this week, it's, you know, you have President Trump breaking down, demolishing the East Wing. The East Wing of the White House was the wing of the First Ladies, by the way. Also paving over the Rose Garden, which was put in by Jacqueline Kennedy, interestingly. But you have one Republican congresswoman after another, Mace, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Boebert, joining with Massey in demanding the Epstein files be released. Do you think more this will happen with more? And you have this unbelievable move of the House Speaker not seating an elected representative because he doesn't want the Epstein files released. That's what a lot of people are analyzing it as.
Well, I think that's absolutely correct analysis. I mean, say what you will about Jeffrey Epstein, the guy's dead and he can still shut down Congress. You know, that's pretty rare. You know, I don't think this Epstein files thing is really very complicated. Most of us aren't worried about being on the Epstein files, in the Epstein files. The only person who would not want it released is someone who was worried about being in it, and that goes to Donald Trump. And you have to grasp here, Amy, is the degree to which the Republican subculture, maybe 45, 50% of the party, has made the Epstein files for a decade, really, to be a great cause. There's a part of an international conspiracy of child molesters that run a secret government like the Illuminati, and Epstein was at the center of this. And they believe this, and it's become sort of an article of faith. So now you have the people who made fortunes out of becoming popular podcast hosts, like Don Bongino, of beating the drum to release the Epstein files. Cash Patel. Now they're in a position where they can. And they're not doing it. So that's a natural tension there. And I think it's going to play out, and it's ultimately going to have to be released, at least to some degree. When we talk about the Epstein files, it's sort of, what are we really talking about? There's such a vast trove of information, digital and otherwise, that was seized by the FBI. I don't think we're going to know what all of it is, but I think we'll know more than we know now.
Can you talk about the ad campaign that you're involved with the Lincoln Project?
Yeah, look, the Lincoln Project, just to kind of go to the origin story, you know, was formed by a small group of Republican consultants who felt that Donald Trump was a great threat to the country. And we looked at this that, for better or worse, we have certain skills that we've developed helping to elect Republicans. Some of these Democrats don't do as well as we do. There's other things that Democrats do better. And our mission really was to appeal to a group of voters who are reluctant to support Donald Trump but need encouragement not to. Soft Republicans, some of these independents and Democrats. I mean, going back to 2020, this is what Steve Bannon said sort of famously, if these guys can get 5 to 6% of Republicans to vote for Biden, it's going to be a problem. And we started calling that the Bannon line. You know, it is our frustration of the hesitancy of the Democratic Party to be more assertive. I mean, if you step back from it, Amy, we have this lunatic president who's appointing Russian stooges, drunks, lunatics like RFK Jr. Across the government. We're tearing down the East Wing. And we're talking about what's wrong with the Democratic Party? I really, how did this happen? Now, you're talking to somebody I spent years pointing out flaws in the Democratic Party, but it is the only pro-democracy party in America now. The Republican Party has really become an extremist movement. So we're very good in the Lincoln Project at working inside the Republican Party. We do a series of ads we call the Audience of One, and we run it where we know Trump is going to see it, which means we buy a lot of golf channels in Mar-a-Lago and Bedford. And he responds to it. And it's a extraordinary ability. If you go back to Hillary Clinton said that we shouldn't have a president who responds to a tweet, this guy responds to everything. And we're trying to increase those tensions, because the more that the Republican Party fights internally, the less effective it is.
I wanted to go to one of those Lincoln Project ads that ran last year about Trump's racism against Puerto Ricans.
We are Puerto Ricans, and we are Americans. But Donald Trump doesn't see us that way. We remember what he did to us after Hurricane Maria. We were dying by the thousands while he threw paper towels at us like we were a joke. Because he thinks we are garbage.
I don't know if you guys know this, but there's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah, I think it's called Puerto Rico.
We are not your punchline. We know who we are. We are proud Americans, proud Puerto Ricans. And we see who you are. You are racist. You are a liar. You are the one that is garbage. And we know where real garbage belongs. In the trash.
So, Stuart Stevens, as we begin to wrap up, your comment on this, and also what's happening in Vermont. On the one hand, you have the governor, Phil Scott, not agreeing to the whole issue of federalizing the National Guard. And then you have Sam Douglas, the Vermont state senator, being forced to step down. He resigned over racist and anti-Semitic comments, like referring to an Indian woman as someone who just didn't bathe off enough. In another instance, Brianna Douglas, Sam's wife and the Vermont Young Republicans National Committee member, saying her husband may have erred by expecting the Jew to be honest. Can you comment on the whole Republicans, Young Republicans scandal and what it's done in the country?
Yeah, you know, look, there always was an ugly side to the Republican Party. Those of us who are involved in the Bush campaign, the compassionate conservative side, we saw this dark side. I mean, literally, like me, Nicole Wallace, Matthew Dowd, Mark McKinnon, Pete Wayne, we used to literally sit in the same room. But I think that we thought that we were the dominant gene of the party, and that the party would come our way, if only because the country was changing so much. And I don't know any conclusion to come to, but that I was wrong. We were the recessive gene. And the party now has become what the party wants. So you have this generation of kids that came of age, a lot of them knowing nothing but Trump. And this is where transgressive behavior becomes a mark of purity. And really, the Republican Party has become an extremist movement. What we know about extremist movements is it demands more and more purity checks. So it's ugly. There's much about, we don't talk enough about race in American politics, I think. Trump's coalition in 20 was 85% white in a country that's, what, 59% white and less after this show. He did a little better in the last election. It was 84% white. So the base of Trump's support is non-college educated white voters, which is the fastest declining large demographic in America. And they know this, which is why they're trying to curate the election and make it whiter and make it less educated. And I'll just say about Phil Scott, who I helped work in some of his campaigns. You know, if the Republican Party had any sense, they would look at Phil Scott as one of the most popular governors, if not the most popular governor in the country, who's a Republican in a heavily Democratic state. And they would go to him and say, what can we learn? What can you teach us? Because if we Republicans could carry states like Vermont or Massachusetts, where Charlie Baker was, or Maryland, where Larry Hogan, all clients of mine, were governors, we would rule the earth. We would always win. Instead, they've made these governors, like an increasingly small number of them, like a Phil Scott, they just ignore them. So Phil Scott did the right thing here. He said, no, I'm not going to have somebody that is a Republican who is writing this racist stuff. I mean, why is this even complicated?
Stuart Stevens, we're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you.
Former Republican political consultant, senior advisor to the Lincoln Project, writes for the Lincoln Square Substack. Next up, a new documentary called Criminal, drawing attention to the Harris County Jail in Houston, Texas, where at least 15 people have already died this year. Back in 20 seconds.
Now here in this system...
by Stu Stewart from the soundtrack of the new documentary Criminal, which we'll talk about in a minute. This year, President Trump signed two executive orders that aim to eliminate so-called cashless bail and threaten to cut federal funding to Washington, D.C. and other jurisdictions that keep the policy in place. Cashless bail, a system in which people accused of minor offenses are released from jail while awaiting trial without having to pay a specific cash amount because they can't afford it. Next month, Texans will vote on Prop 3, which would amend the state's constitution to allow judges to deny bail to people charged with certain felonies. This comes as at least 15 people have died in the Harris County Jail in Houston, Texas this year, including just two this month. Most people in jail have yet to go to trial but cannot afford to pay bail for their release. Now, a new animated musical documentary short film called Criminals drawing attention to the crisis. This is the trailer.
More than 9,000 people dwell in this waterfront property. Its impressive facade might compel or inspire those with the dough to peek in and inquire. Who wants a condo with a wonderful view right here in downtown Houston? Follow me, I'll show you. Upon closer inspection, let me lift the veil on the third largest hell in America. The Harris County Jail.
One thing that a lot of people don't appreciate about Harris County Jail is it looks very beautiful from the outside. It's overlooking the bayou and the water in downtown Houston. There's all of these windows. One thing people don't understand is that these windows are fake.
Windows without a view. A metaphor too perfectly sad to be true.
That, in a nutshell, really captures the facade, the veneer of what we call justice.
Criminal... just us.
It's
criminal. The trailer for Criminal. And this is a clip from the new film, which features Alec Karakatsanis, author of Capaganda, who we'll hear from in a minute. This clip begins with a call from a Harris County jail prisoner.
I have, as of today, incarcerated for over 13 months. My next court date is not until the last week of July. That's 6 months of dry sitting in jail for a so-called crime I never committed. Now I'm ready to become a felon just to get out of jail or at least get this train moving. That's 1 year already wasted.
But most of us don't go to trial.
The money goes to support
The money bail system is built to coerce guilty pleas. In Harris County, Texas, in misdemeanor cases, if you're too poor to afford a couple hundred dollars to get out of jail, you plead guilty 84% of the time, and you do so in about 3.2 days.
It's too expensive to be innocent.
That's a clip from the animated musical documentary short film Criminal, which was published this month on the New Yorker magazine website. Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I recently spoke to three people involved with the film, Stu Stewart, Tony Award winner, singer-songwriter behind the critically acclaimed Broadway musical Passing Strange. His music and lyrics are featured in Criminal. He's a professor of the practice of musical theater writing at Harvard. Krish Gundu is executive director of the Texas Jail Project. And Alec Karakatsanis is the founder of the Civil Rights Corps and author of Copaganda, How Police and the Media Manipulate Our News. We began by asking Alec about his comment in the film that, quote, there's no presumption of innocence in practice in the American legal system if you're poor. This was his response.
Every single night, and right now as we're talking, there are hundreds of thousands of human beings in jail cells all over this country solely because their families lack cash to pay for their pretrial release. The United States and the Philippines are the only two countries in the world that have a for-profit commercial money bail industry, which means that in the vast majority of cases all over the country, every single day, the reason that children are separated from their parents, the reason people are taken away from their homes and jobs and schools and churches and communities is not that anyone has determined that they're a danger to the community or anyone has made a reasoned decision based on evidence that they should be jailed, but because they lack access to cash. And what this ends up doing is it ends up creating millions of coerced guilty pleas every single year all across the country just because people are so desperate to get out because they're deprived of their medication, there's no one to take care of their pets, they don't know where their children are. All of these horrific things are happening to people in this country solely because they lack access to pay for pretrial money bail. And this is unconstitutional, and it's the work that we've devoted ourselves to over the last decade at Civil Rights Corps.
And Krish, could you speak about your work? You are co-founder and executive director of the Texas Jail Project, and you're featured in this documentary as well. If you could talk specifically about what you know of what happens at Harris County Jail.
So Harris County Jail is the largest warehouse of people with mental illness in the state of Texas. Every time I say that, I find it so hard to believe, but that is what we've decided to do as a society, is to invest in punitive solutions to public health issues. So today, if you look at the Harris County Jail dashboard, out of the 8,763 people that are being held in jail, 78% are tagged as psychiatric. 78%. So we're the largest warehouse of people with serious mental illness in the state of Texas. Not a state hospital, not any kind of psych facility, but a county jail. Where the pretrial detention percentage is 67.8%. So what we're essentially doing is we're locking people up for their illness. We have criminalized mental illness. We've criminalized homelessness. We've criminalized reproductive rights. And so the jail has become the emergency room of our community. And as a result, what you see are all these horrific deaths in our jail. So this year we've had, this calendar year, we have had 15 reported deaths, 15. Out of that, at least six were people who had cycled through both the mental health and the jail system for years and years and years and never received the appropriate level of care that they needed. And also the people who died in our jail disproportionately are people with serious mental illness and medical issues, and so they can't advocate for their medical needs, which is why they end up in sort of horrific tragedies. And I'll give you one quick example of one of the deaths this year. Young man, 39 years old, he struggled with severe schizophrenia, and he died of a completely treatable throat infection, just a simple strep throat infection, because he was not able to advocate for himself. And when we got his records and his autopsy report, his medical records and autopsy report, it turned out that he had starved to death because his throat closed up. So those are the kind of deaths that we're seeing in our jail.
Stu, I wanted to ask you about your collaboration with Thomas Curtis. He was incarcerated for 11 years. How does his experience affect the visual language of the piece, this very unusual collaboration between, you know, a regular documentary exposing the Harris County Jail and it almost being a kind of really profound music video?
Well, it's actually far more unusual than you could even imagine, because when Heidi and I were creating the music, we never saw a single frame of what Thomas was doing. And that seems shocking to a lot of people, but I actually think the fact that we were working independently meant that we were investing deeply in the music and doing our best to serve the truth of the film. And we weren't worried about serving an image, and Thomas didn't have to necessarily worry about serving the music. He was just doing his thing, we were doing ours, and there were no conversations. There literally were no conversations. We just, both parties just did what they do, and you see the result.
Had you known about the Harris County jail system before you wrote this musical piece? It opens with you describing this Harris County jail in downtown Houston that looks like a high-rise with windows. And as you sing about it, there are no windows, actually. Those are not windows.
No, turning the facts into lyrics was, you know, incredibly challenging and worrisome sometimes. But the thing is, I come from Los Angeles, so I grew up in Daryl Gates's, you know, LAPD. You know, I was bailing friends out of jail by pawning my guitar amps while I was still in high school. So I grew up with this. So that part I was familiar with from the police state that Los Angeles was that I grew up in. I was very familiar with this. I was not familiar with Houston specifically, but the feeling of what was going on was absolutely something I was completely familiar with.
I want to go to another clip from Criminal that looks at the conditions at the Harris County Jail during COVID-19 pandemic.
And then COVID hit.
Some of these men filed a civil lawsuit just to get mops and brooms.
Yeah, after 4 weeks of sweeping with newspaper and mopping our pod with our towels. Yeah, we got 26 in a cell. And often the food is tossed in there through or under the door. Sometimes the guards count wrong, or other prisoners even take more than one before everyone gets theirs.
I spent 7 days in quarantine, which meant solitary confinement. I was supposed to get out an hour once a day, but with 26 cells all in a row, if the guards changed shifts before they got to my cell, sometimes they missed me, and I'd be in there for 36 hours straight. It was hell. Sometimes they'd have me go alone for more than a day with no food, no lounge time. Two prisoners died while I was in there.
Harris County Jail issued this statement in response to the film. Harris County implemented aggressive health measures to reduce the spread of COVID-19 in the jail in spite of the crowded conditions. As a result, the jail's COVID-19 mortality rate was far below the mortality rates reported in other major U.S. jails. In fact, the overall mortality rate for the Harris County Jail has consistently ranked below the state and national jail average, including in 2022. Krish Gundu, can you respond to this?
I think the national mortality rate, that whole conversation is a distraction. It is a distraction from what is actually happening in our jails. It has been happening since way before COVID, and it has been happening through COVID and post-COVID. If you look at the kind of deaths that happen in our jail, and I don't know if you caught this earlier, the number of people who are dying in our jail, there's a disproportionate number of them who have serious mental illness and disabilities. These are people who cannot advocate for themselves. And so instead of just looking at the numbers, we need to look at the stories. And I'll tell you a real quick story, two stories if you have time for it. One, a young man, 39 years old, who died in our jail. He had severe schizophrenia, and he died of a perfectly treatable throat infection. He had a strep throat infection, which was easily treatable, but because he couldn't advocate for himself because of his schizophrenia.